Well, thanks, Dale, for inviting me to address astrophotography. I'm sure many of you could do a better job. So this will be kind of a learning experience, and feel free to jump in and add to what I have to say. You know, this cord that I've had so many knots here, Thomas and I had to untie these earlier. It reminds me of the two fundamental axioms of astronomy. Any single cable will become tangled. Any two cables will become tangled among themselves. And this, to me, is the greatest proof of string theory. But anyway, my remote is not working, I don't think, is it? Yeah, it is. Okay. Well, we've all had the privilege. We're part of that dwindling number of citizens that have had the privilege of being out in a truly dark sight on a moonless night and looked up at the spectacle of the heavens. Didn't look much different from that for me at Kitt Peak a few years ago when I was up there. But for some, that kind of transitory experience of visual observation, they want to move beyond that to actually trying to record what they're seeing. And that's the topic for tonight's presentation. And Dale, by the way, how much time do we have? Till, did you tell me 10:30? Not much? Okay. The human eye is a marvelous organ. You know, it light that is emitted or reflected by an object enters through the lens and then is focused on the retina. And then the brain translates that into an image through a cascade of marvelous events. What an amazing story. And yet that is a very transitory phenomenon, because the eye refreshes multiple times per second and cannot accumulate light. So we cannot see deeply. We see superficially. And so throughout the centuries, who might this be for extra credit, by the way? You got it. Tycho Brahe. Probably the greatest of the pre-telescope astronomers, a Danish astronomer, kind of took visual observation to the apex, to the zenith. And on the little island of Hven, off the coast of Denmark, virtually every clear night for 20 years, he would observe and map the heavens. And yet he was not able really to extract fundamental principles from the data he was accumulating. That task was left to his young assistant, Johannes Kepler, who, upon the untimely and still mysterious death of Brahe, Kepler got possession of 20 years of cartography and pored over those charts, and to his credit, was able, with that information, I couldn't have done it, to come up with the three laws of planetary motion. One of which, the third law, a simple equation, is how we today, 400 years later, determine the mass of stars and galaxies. Well, then Galileo is the first person that we know of that invented a telescope. The telescope, you might say a binocular, had actually been invented by some Danish opticians a few years before, but Galileo is the first person to take this invention and use it for astronomical purposes. Here we see his two principal refractors that he built. The one on the left was 9 power, and the one on the right was about 30 power. And you can see the tandem there on the right. This is one of my favorite quotes from Galileo's journal. Shortly after he first started observing with his telescopes, "Beyond the faintest stars the eye can see, you will behold through the telescope a host of other stars which escape the unassisted sight, so numerous as to be beyond belief." How many of us can relate with that sentiment? You know, Dale, just taking that 20-inch, as I used to do. By the way, can I cancel that sale? And yeah. No, okay. that's why I got the 18-inch. But, you know, I'm glad I did, because I'm looking for portability. But one of my favorite things to do with that 20-inch was just late at night, just randomly sweeping without looking for anything in particular. Just the spectacle of seeing literally stars to the limit of human perception. was just an amazing and most enjoyable experience. Well, and so for centuries, even after the invention of the telescope, the most we could do to replicate the images we were seeing was sketching, which, by the way, remains a significant contribution to astronomy and a significant art form. Here we see an artist's sketch of M13, and you can see that dark lanes that form that kind of inverted Y there, which is very visible in photographs. And this is M31, the Andromeda Galaxy. This is M84 and M86 in Virgo. So we can see, as beautiful as these are in some respects, they leave something, they're lacking in the sense that all the artist is doing is portraying what he or she is seeing through the eyepiece of the telescope. Well, what about the earliest astrophotographs? And by the way, astrophotography is such a beautiful term to me, even photography. It comes from two Greek words, photos, which means light, and graphis, which means painting or drawing. And so you're painting light with a photo. And what better use of this term than in astronomy? We're painting light from the cosmos. And this story takes us back to the invention of the camera obscura, which is a Latin term that just means dark room or dark area. And what happened in Aristotle's Physics, 5th century BC, he refers to the camera obscura, one of the earliest, probably the earliest known reference. And the idea was this: if you take a box that's completely enclosed and you put a pinhole on one side, and if you can observe the back of that box through some other portal, you will see an inverted image of what the box is pointing at. Kind of an amazing phenomenon. In fact, here's a picture of a 17th century version of it, using a lens to perfect that image. There was a famous Dutch painter by the name of Johannes Vanier, who painted about 50 paintings that have survived. And he was considered an obscure, second-rate painter in his day. But in more recent years, there's been a reassessment. And many have elevated him to a much higher status. And there's arisen a debate as to whether he used a camera obscura in painting several of his paintings, including this one, the girl. This one is entitled Music Lessons, I believe. And you can see this young lady. This is a poor quality image that I have for you here. And you can see the mirror here. Her face is seen in a reflection, actually. But many think that Vanier actually had a camera obscura set up in his studio, and that's why his paintings are so realistic. And that debate continues to this day. He never addressed the issue one way or the other. Well, what about the first permanent picture? That was taken by Joseph Nietz, who was a French inventor, early 19th century. The first image he took, that humanity took, that we know of, was in 1826. He dissolved some bitumen in lavender oil and coated a sheet of pewter with the mixture. This is kind of how we do astrophotography today. He placed the sheet in a camera and exposed it for 8 hours, aimed through an open window at his courtyard. The light forming the image on the plate hardened the bitumen in the brighter areas and left it soft and soluble in the dark areas. And then he washed the plate with lavender oil, which removed the soft bitumen that hadn't been struck by light, leaving a permanent image. This next slide is the first photographic image ever taken. We've come a long way. Well, Louis Daguerre, another Frenchman, found out about this process, wanted to learn more, and they formed a collaboration for a number of years. And Daguerre actually took this process to a much higher level with what we now know as the daguerreotype. He substituted silver film and iodine vapors that formed a thin film on the silver. And then it was exposed to light, and then that silver was taken and put in a chamber where you had superheated mercury. And the mercury vapors came up and formed and darkened the areas that had been exposed to the most light. Kind of an amazing process. It was the daguerreotype, it became known as. This is the first daguerreotype taken by Daguerre. That's not a human head there, by the way. It is a bust of somebody. And that was 1837. In the years that followed, many famous daguerreotypes were published. In fact, there were thousands of itinerant photographers roaming the country. The idea of me being able to have a picture of my family or a portrait of myself that was not a painting by some second-rate artist that I could afford that didn't bear any resemblance to reality. This was us. And these people became immensely popular, and the prices came down with that popularity. Here's some of the more famous daguerreotypes of the 1840s. The first known image of Abraham Lincoln. 1846, member of the Illinois State Legislature, I believe, at that time. Emily Dickinson, age 17, 1846. The first astrophoto that we know of, taken by John Henry Draper, 1838 to 1840, of the moon. Looks better than some of the first attempts of mine, I'll tell you. Excuse me?
Is there any metadata about the photograph itself?
Yes. We know that it's a 20-minute exposure. You try taking a 20-minute exposure of the moon today. I mean, 1/20th of a second will be totally overexposed. But that was one of the problems with daguerreotypes. They were very slow. Some images took over 8 hours. Here was a picture taken by American astronomer John Whipple, 1850, another daguerreotype. If you want me to move into the modern era, I will, but I kind of found this kind of interesting in the history. You want me to keep going? We're almost done. Here's the Springfield Astronomy Club in 1860. Actually, this is a group of American... His grandfather. <yeah. laughs> Here's a picture of a group of Americans who had traveled to Spain in 1860 to see a total solar eclipse. And they brought their cameras with them to take daguerreotypes of that event. So here we see, in 1860, astrophotography had become popular. They had two major drawbacks, however. As I said, they were very slow. But just as importantly, they only made a positive image, not a negative. So it was impossible to make copies or duplicates of any image that you took. That was a serious flaw. 1840, the process of photography accelerates. Henry Talbot announced a new technique which became the basis for modern photography. He called it the calotype, Greek for beautiful picture. This process, unlike the daguerreotype, involved a negative and a positive image. So it could be repeatable indefinitely in a positive print, allowing for multiple copies. By 1880, a dry plate process was developed that allowed a very fast development and opening up the entire field of astrophotography and of photography in general to the broader public. Here's the first calotype taken in 1850, a famous photo that's called The Open Door. The first true photograph. This is a picture taken in 1876 with this new photographic process by Lewis Carroll. A pedophile, by the way, in his studio. Now here's some of the early photographic images, not the daguerreotype images. These are with the photographic process I just described. This is the first known image of the Horsehead Nebula. Right here. Very difficult object even today to image. M31, perhaps the first photographic image of it, 1880. You can see M32 very clearly. I guess, well, would this be 32 here and this 109? 110. 110, I mean? Yeah. The Pleiades. The first known picture of the Orion Nebula, taken with the new photographic process. Several hour exposure. 1883, a wider field image. Not bad. Better than my first attempts, as you'll see later this evening. A picture of the moon, much more detail showing now with this new photographic process. Before the invention of photography, observers sat at telescopes and sketched what they saw, but combining the optics of a telescope with a specially constructed camera to make the first photographic plates took place in the 1840s. By the turn of the 1900s, astronomers turned their attention to making telescopes specifically for photography rather than observing. This in turn led to even better imaging of galaxies and star clusters, as well as better spectral images for scientific analysis. So here's kind of the breakdown historically. From the 1830s to 1860s, we had the daguerreotypes, and roughly the 1860s to the 1970s, you had film emulsions. And then starting in the 1970s through today, you have the emergence of CCD technology, which we'll return to here shortly. So for imaging, the way I look at it, there are really four parts to the puzzle. Four components. If you want to get involved in astrophotography, of course you need a you don't need a telescope, but it's certainly helpful to have a telescope. Actually, you don't need one. I mean, there's some wonderful things you can do without a telescope. Just put your telescope pointed at Polaris and from a dark location, and leave the shutter open for an hour or two, and you see the amazing star trails. And something else you'll see is that not only do all the stars rotate around the northern celestial pole, but so does Polaris. Alpha, Canis, Ursa Minoris. Polaris is not the true north celestial pole. And you see that in a 5 or 10 minute image pointed with just a camera with no telescope at the North Star. And of course, you need a mount to put the telescope and the camera on. And you need the camera. And, you know, this isn't necessary, but autoguider. We'll talk about these individually. Let's talk about telescopes. What kind of telescopes are the best for imaging? Well, that's a hotly debated topic over which passions run deeply. Not necessarily. Let's take a look at the four major types. Number one, you got the refractor. Galileo's telescope. In fact, Newton himself in the 1670s and 80s, or 1660s actually, was convinced that the major problem of the refractor of that day up until today, which is chromatic aberration, could never be solved. And so that's why he turned his attention to developing an entirely new revolutionary type of telescope, the Newtonian reflector. But the main problem with the refractor was and is chromatic aberration. Do you know that visible light, that tiny little sliver on our electromagnetic spectrum that ranges 20 million miles of all forms of radiation, visible light is 1/100th the width of a piece of paper in a 20 million mile wide spectrum. That's what we see. That's what the human eye can see. As red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. One octave.
From blue to red is one octave.
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it, yeah. You know, just like the human heart beats in a minor third. My wife is a musician. I think she told me it was a minor third. And that's why there's an intrinsic desire for music in minor thirds. Many children's melodies are in minor thirds. Is that because of the heartbeat? But anyway, it's interesting that the associations between music and science. But the point is this. those elements of visible light have different indices of refraction, meaning they're refracted slightly differently by media. Okay? Now, you take glass, for example, they refract differently, meaning they come to a focus point at a different place. And that's why with a what we call an achromatic refractor, you see blue and purple halos around the stars or the objects. It's very, what should I say, it detracts significantly from the visual effect. This problem that Newton said was insoluble was not solved until really the latter 20th century with the invention of fluorite, which is a human-made crystalline substance that has a very low dispersion and, as a result, brings the various elements of visible light to a focus at about the same point. Similarly, we have ED glass, extra dispersion glasses that are not quite as good as fluorite. For example, all the Takahashi and astrophysics refractors, those high-end refractors, they're all fluorite in construction. Some are triplets, some are doublets. But they essentially eliminate chromatic aberration. But you're going to pay for it. Like I have a Takahashi 90 millimeter that I still have, a Sky 90. That's just a little 90 millimeters, 3.5 inches. You know, it's 10 pounds. But that thing's $2,000. It's a doublet fluorite lens. And I had a triplet Takahashi 130 millimeter, five inch diameter. In fact, most of the images on my website were taken with that instrument, which I sold to get the Ritchie Cretan. Small apertures, and these things are very costly, unless you want to go for the achromatic, which does not avoid the chromatic aberration. The apochromatic, the APO, they're sometimes called, are the refractors like the TACs and the APs that avoid that problem. Now, yeah, here's a picture of me with my little TAC. And here I am with my 5-inch tack before I sold it. The opticians in Japan actually sign it there on the that light guard there. Okay, let's talk about the next type of telescope, reflectors. These have obviously the most light-gathering area for the money. But they have certain problems. They have very long focal lengths. Many of them do anyway. So the telescopes tend to be large and heavy, meaning you can't put them on a German equatorial mount. In fact, you don't have a mount at all for the big ones. They're Dobsonians. Now, there's certain ways around that. Like I have the equatorial platform. I can put a Dob on. I'm glad I didn't sell that, Dale, because it works with the 18-inch, the UC. But I can track for 75 minutes with that thing and photograph with it, probably 5 or 10 minutes. So I'm looking forward to trying that. Guiding's a real problem with these telescopes. It's really an insurmountable problem unless you get a small one like a 6 or 8 inch. And they're characterized by coma, meaning kind of an elongation of stars along the entire boundary of the image. Not visually, but photographically that happens. It's an artifact that's it degrades from the image substantially. And there's the 20-inch that Dale now owns. Can I get out of that deal? Can I rescind that contract? That's okay. The Schmidt-Cassegrain, probably the most popular telescope today. By the way, do you know which sells more, Sky and Telescope or Astronomy?
Astronomy.
50% more sales than Sky and Telescope. I just read that the other day. I knew it was above.
Talking about readership?
Circulation. Yeah. I'd have to say that magazine's really improved in recent years. I've been amazed in the last year at the quality of the articles in there. Schmidt-Cassegrain. It is the most popular platform. Why? Because they're so compact and they're easy. They got that fork mount, and you can immediately set it up and start and use the go-to feature and tracking feature, guiding, so you can look at an object for extended periods of time with it right in the crosshairs. They have a spheroidal mirror rather than a parabolic, and so they do require a corrector plate. But the spheroidal mirror is much cheaper to make, and it makes the cost of the telescope, you know, it doesn't get out of hand. It has a convex secondary mirror, a large central obstruction, but they are compact and very portable. They're more costly than reflectors, but they're far cheaper per inch than an APO refractor or a Ritchie Cretan, that's for sure. They have that fork mount, which, as we'll see, is not the greatest for imaging. It's fantastic for go-to and tracking and guiding. Here's a picture of a couple of Meade Schmidt-Cassegrains. And then the final one I want to mention is a variant of the Cassegrain, and that's the Ritchie Cretan. It's considered optically superior to all the other options, even the APOs. It's got two hyperboloidal mirrors, so there's a lot of manual work in the construction of these things, and that's what makes the cost so high. But they do eliminate coma completely, although they do introduce astigmatism, which can be easily, of course, countered with appropriate lens. They have long focal lengths, so you have no wide field views with these things. You're looking at close-ups. I'll give you some examples in just a minute. Short focal ratios mean you do have short exposures. So it's kind of the ideal. You have high magnification, short exposure. And to a certain extent, you can get wide field views by getting the large format new SBIG cameras, for example, and you have much bigger field of view. I'm not done yet. choice of, yes, they're the first choice of all observatories. Any telescope of over 50 inch, 40 inch for that matter, probably in the last 50 years has been a Ritchie Cretan, including the Hubble Space Telescope. And they're the choice of all the leading imagers today. But they do have high cost. But it's an investment. All I can say is it has to do with the optical train. I'm not an expert on that, but I think it has to do with those two. Yes. Mm-hmm. That was the goal sought for these major. Most of these, the original ones were for observatories only. I mean, they've only made it to the amateur market in the last 10 years. But when you're a committee trying to figure out what kind of telescope you want for the new observatory, I mean, that's exactly what you want. And that's, pardon me?
The short focal ratio for gathering a lot of light.
Right.
And then your long focal lengths for higher power.
Higher power, that's exactly right. And you'll see some examples of that in a moment. This is probably the leading platform right here for the elite imagers today, the amateurs. The Ron Wadowski, the Rob Gendler, Russell Crowman. I mean, those are probably the three greatest imagers in the world today, amateurs. They all have this model, a 20-inch Ritchie Cretan made by RCOS, Ritchie Cretan Optical Company in Flagstaff, Arizona. That's where I got my 14.5. In fact, I ordered a 12.5, and I called Brad Earhorn, who's the founder of that company, and I said, Brad, I've done my homework. I've decided I want to get the 12.5. He says, well, I'm making one for myself, and if you want that, you can have it in 2 weeks. I said, I'll take it. So 2 weeks go by. I hadn't heard from him. 2 months go by. 6 months go by. And I finally emailed him. I said, Brad, you know, I'm a patient person. But, you know, I'm an attorney. And if I treated my clients like this, I'd be run out of town. So he emailed back. I tried to be, you know, cordial in the letter. But he was so embarrassed. And he emailed me right back. He said, Rich, no words on my part could convey my heartache at reading your words. I am so embarrassed and ashamed. And to make it up to you in some small measure, it's going to take another 6 months to get you one of these. But we have 14.5-inch ion milled scopes ready for delivery. I'm going to upgrade you at no charge. I mean, I couldn't believe it. That was a $15,000 upgrade. It was worth 6 months, believe me. So that's what I got, and it was delivered a couple of weeks later. But I'm glad I ordered the Paramount mount instead of the much smaller astrophysics mount, or I wouldn't have been able to support it. There I am with the new baby. And there's our granddaughter. I'm trying to train her on the finer points of astrophotography. She kind of gets the basic idea, I think. Okay, let's talk about the next component, and that's mounts. Well, you got two choices. The fork mount, which is the standard mount for your Schmidt-Cassegrain scopes. It's fantastic for visual observing, go-to, good tracking. I had an LX200 10-inch Meade for 4 or 5 years. I was absolutely amazed. In fact, they may still do this, quote a letter that I wrote to them in their annual catalog of how blown away I was by the ability of that telescope to find an object and to track it. It was far better than the Takahashi mount that I had. And I'm still not an expert at the Paramount mount. That thing is built for fixed observatories. So every night I have to roll that thing out of the garage on the wheelie bars, set it up, and go through this T-point model, which is the same model and software that's used by the Gemini telescope on Mauna Kea and most of the big telescopes up there. They do it once. I do it every night. At first, it took me 3 hours to figure out to align my telescope. And I said, man, this is ridiculous. But I've got it down to about 10 minutes now. So just through sheer hard work and determination. Some nights it still takes me an hour, but I've done it in as few as 10 minutes. But I'm looking for a permanent observatory. Can you imagine doing this one night, doing 300 or 400 objects syncing on it, and you're done forever? You just turn the power on next week and you're ready to go. I can't even imagine it. Anyway, these forks are not good for precision or long exposure images, but they're cheap. You know, the cost of an LX200 includes the mount plus the OTA. And then the German equatorial mount, the other big option. Paramount ME is like what I've got that I just showed you, that red thing. You got the Takahashi, the Astrophysics, Losmandy, all make, you know, first-rate German equatorial mounts. They have precise tracking and go-to. They're more expensive. And they have the problem of crossing the meridian. Unlike a fork mount, with a gem, you know, when you're imaging. And so I always have to pick out objects about 2 hours before they cross the meridian. And that's when I image it, because I know I got about 15 minutes after they cross, and it's all over. I can't track anymore. And that's a hassle, believe me. You have to go in through that. And there are ways that you can flip it and come out on the other side, but you have an inverted image then. There's certain software issues. And I haven't done that yet. Cameras. Well, let's start with digital cameras. And this really, I think the best way to understand this is to go back to 1905. In that year, a young Swiss patent examiner by the name of Albert Einstein publishes 3 papers, any one of which deserved the Nobel Prize, in my opinion. Special theory of relativity, Brownian motion, and the photoelectric effect. It was the photoelectric effect for which he received the Nobel Prize in 1921, not the special theory of relativity. And what is the photoelectric effect? It is this kind of bizarre phenomenon that people were aware of, but nobody had really articulated or explained it, where you bombard certain metals with electrons or photons, and they convert to electrons. A photon converts to an electron, or it emits an electron from certain substances like silicon. Well, that was the foundation for CCD imaging, because that's what a CCD camera is, whether it's a digital camera or a CCD dedicated astronomical camera. Which room are you looking for? Okay, well, welcome. Renaissance art, is that what you're... So the idea is this. You know, that silicon chip, it's just like looking at a football field filled with 8-ounce cups, all touching one another. And when it rains, those things start to fill up, don't they? In fact, some of them are going to fill up more fully than others. And the same thing is true with light. When the light strikes that silicon chip, that CCD chip, some of those pixels overflow onto their neighbors, and that's called blooming. And that's a major problem with some CCD cameras, like my SBIG ST10. That thing is a non-anti-blooming camera. I don't know why they just don't say blooming, but it's non-anti-blooming. And, man, that thing blooms, but it's very fast, too. It's at least twice as fast as the anti-blooming. But the anti-blooming, you can just leave them on forever, and you don't have blooming. But anyway, that's the essential concept of what's going on. But isn't that awesome to think about that? That little chip in that camera, that image you're getting, is nothing less than the reinterpretation of the photons that have come from that galaxy 60 million light years away. Your little camera has captured some of those photons that have been traversing the trackless miles of intergalactic space for an eternity until their ageless journey was captured by your CCD chip and converted into electrons. What an amazing story. I get goosebumps thinking about it. So anyway, that's the story. And there's all kinds of digital cameras. You got the point-and-shoot camera. Can you do astrophotography with that? Absolutely. Stick it. I've done it. You put it in front of the eyepiece and take a picture of the moon or a planet. What are the advantages? They're called digicams, point-and-shoot. They're cheap. They're simple. They're very intuitive. You can just take it out of the box and use it. And they're a great starter camera. Disadvantages, well, you know, I don't want to harp on this, but they're afocal, meaning images have to be taken through both the camera lens and the telescope eyepiece, which increases the focal ratio and reduces the speed substantially. You can't take extended pictures with these things. So you're stuck with the solar system. They have excessive noise. They're not cooled. Okay, so those are some of the disadvantages, but I just want to say, for those of you that haven't tried astrophotography, that's the simplest way to get started. And you can take some awesome images that way. And then moving up the line, here's a Canon 10D. That was the first DSLR that I had, digital single lens reflex camera, which is another form of CCD camera. All of these use CCD chips. What are the advantages and disadvantages? Well, as far as the advantages, they're cheaper than an SBIG dedicated CCD camera by a factor of 5, probably, or more. They're dual purpose, like my 10D that you just saw a picture of. I could take pictures of flowers and people with it. It wasn't dedicated to it. Man, you try doing that with an SBIG camera, having your family picture. No laptop is required for these things. I mean, you can. Maxim, for example, has software out that operates these cameras. Some are especially made for photography, like the Canon 20DA. I don't know if that's still made. I know they were discontinuing that. John, have they discontinued that? Is there anything that's replaced it? Is Canon? Didn't they say they're coming out with something else?
They talked about it, but
the market's not there. Okay. They easily attach to telescope with the prime focus. These are awesome. I mean, I'll tell you what. You're going to make a huge jump going from the digicam to one of these. In fact, some of the images I've seen and some of that I've taken with the digicam rival some dedicated CCD images. That gap is narrowing. DSLRs. So you just wonder, why pay 5 times more for a dedicated CCD? It's amazing. What are the disadvantages of these cameras? Well, they're slightly less sensitive. But again, this disadvantage is this disadvantage is decreasing. And focusing, I got to be honest with you, focusing is the problem. It's not an insurmountable problem, but I know, having imaged with these things for a couple of years, I mean, I tried everything. I tried software. I tried magnifying glasses on the eyepiece, and that was the best thing I did, by the way. And you just painstakingly change the focus, and you can see that star getting smaller or bigger, and that seemed to work pretty well. But focusing was a challenge. Hey, focusing is a challenge with all types of astrophotography. With CCDs, are you kidding me? You're focusing on an object you can't see? Let's talk about them. Oh, man, this brings up bad memories for me. You know, I got this CCD for my LX200. I got an SBIG 7, what do they call it? The ST7E. That was my first CCD camera. And I was so excited. I got that, and I had it for about 3 years, and I was never able to take a photo with it. Couldn't do it. I couldn't figure it out. I read the manual. I bought books on astrophotography. I wasn't a member of this club, so I didn't have your assistance at that time. But I was like a lone ranger out there trying to figure this out. I don't consider myself stupid, but I felt like it. Because I couldn't figure out this. It became a challenge for me. I quit 100 times, but I kept being drawn back by my desire to be like John Henry Draper and take a picture of the moon with his daguerreotype camera. So anyway, the CCD camera. And then, I don't know why in the world I did this, I upgraded my camera to the ST10 XME. That was about five or six years ago. I thought, well, maybe that'll be easier. It was the very same thing. I just compounded my problem. Unbelievable. I tried for years to figure that out. I read manuals. I read books. I couldn't do it. And so what I did, I called SBIG, Santa Barbara Instrument Group in Santa Barbara, California. I said, I give up. I can't operate this camera. I want to fly. I will fly at my expense to California and sit down with somebody at your factory that can show me how to use this camera. I was so embarrassed. Hey, personal embarrassment was no barrier to me anymore. They said, and this guy said, well, we don't give personal tutoring. You're on your own. But he said, there are two tutors that we do know of that do private lessons. I said, do tell. Well, one of them is a guy by the name of Adam Block at the Advanced Observers Program at Kitt Peak Observatory just outside of Tucson, Arizona. Well, to make a long story short, I contacted Adam. I didn't know who the guy was. And we set up an appointment for me to travel to Kitt Peak, as I did 3 years ago this month. And I spent an evening with him. I met him at 5 o'clock, and I was with him till 5 a.m. And that cost $300, including room and board, which I thought that was a pretty incredible deal. It didn't get dark till like 9 o'clock, but up until then, you know, we were just going over any questions that I had. I wrote down all kinds of questions for him. And, in fact, I'd been using CCD Soft, and he told me in advance, I don't use CCD Soft. I only use Maxim DL. So I had to get that software program and try to figure out that manual with utter failure. So all I wanted to do was take a picture with my camera. So this is why the DSLRs look pretty good, don't they? If you can't figure it out with your camera, with the telescope, just take pictures of your family or trees, flowers. So anyway, I felt that night like I was taking a drink out of a fire hydrant. You know, I was able to ingest a little bit, but most of it was just flying fast. But I ingested enough that within a week, in my driveway, I was taking my first images with that camera. Unbelievable experience. M51 was the first one. And to sit there at this laptop screen and see my first image, 5-minute image, of M51 auto-guided appear and see those detail and those spiral arms, the satellite galaxy, I just was blown away by it. I was glad I persevered. I'm a certified diesel mechanic. And that's what I told them at SBIG. I said, I'm not dumb. I'm an attorney, I'm a CPA, I'm an author, and I'm a certified diesel mechanic. So anyway, here's a, oh boy, I have mixed feelings about these people. They wouldn't help me. So here was my first camera, the ST10 dual chip. Oh, those dual chips are great. Right down here is the second chip. This is the imaging chip. They're both CCD, charge coupling devices, the same concept, silicon chips. This one is much smaller, and this is the one that grabs onto a star, and then through a software process, you select it for auto guiding, and the telescope will lock onto that. I'm still amazed by it. Absolute precision auto guiding for hours. It's amazing. Here's my new camera, the STL 11000, large format camera. I'm just starting to figure out how to use that. But I know the basics, and I had it out for a test run Friday night. What do you mean? Well, it's as large as the 35 millimeter negative. Oh, it's about four times the size of this projector. No, it's it's about maybe a third the size of this. Oh, it's compact. That is the size of the digital of the CCD chip. Yeah, so it's 10 times bigger chip than the SD10 camera that I have. Now that camera is still, I decided to keep it because I can take much more magnified views with that, whereas this is more large field, wide field views. And I'm looking forward to taking images with this. This is a monster camera in terms of the pixel size. What are the advantages and disadvantages of the CCDs? Well, the advantages are the sensitivity, the quantum efficiency, that is, back to Einstein, how many photons are converted to electrons? Is it a one-to-one? No camera has a 100% efficiency. But the best CCD cameras now, you're looking at the 60 to 80% range. My new camera is probably in the 80% range as opposed to film, which is 1%. You know, photographic film. Cooled, advantages. Just remember, anything that is moving emits radiation. We don't see it. Like if we turn these lights out, I can't see you, but if I had infrared goggles, each one of you would show up like a candle because you are emitting infrared radiation as you sit here. It's just at a wavelength that the human eye cannot detect. But it's still radiation. And so a non-cooled camera is just permeated with the heat from the camera forming what is called noise or artifacts on the image. The only way to avoid that or diminish that problem is through cooling. Why do you cool it? You're emitting less infrared radiation the cooler you get. If you get it down to absolute zero, there's none. Of course, no cooler goes that low. My cooler goes about 20 degrees below ambient. Okay, 20 to 40. So you have an excellent signal-to-noise ratio. And I can get an auxiliary cooler, which I've never thought that I've needed. Dual chip models allow perfect auto guiding at high magnification. Disadvantages, of course, would be the cost. May I underscore the complexity? You have me now, though. And others, I'm sure, here that are familiar with these cameras. I'm here to help you. In fact, Michael Kolstad, who teaches music at Evangel, who has been to this club a few times, he's been kind of my understudy in astronomy and astrophotography, and that guy is just unbelievable how far he's progressed. He's bought a lot of my equipment. And he took that ST7, my first, the images he's taken with that thing, with my LX200 telescope, man, if I could have done what he's doing, I never would have progressed any further. I'd have been happy with that. But he said, you've taught me more in 15 minutes than I could have learned in years. Just because of that, the voice of experience. I'd been there. I could explain it. He'd call me at 1 o'clock, you know, what do I do about this? And I told him it came with a 24/7 customer support policy when I sold it. Well, he took advantage of that. But his dad is moving here from Colorado. And he said, I want to buy 30 acres about 25 miles out of town. Are you kidding me? And so Mike and I have it all planned that we're trying to tell him the best area to build his house, and he's a contractor, you know, and so we're looking right now going southeast, okay, southeast, and things are looking pretty good. He has his house on the market in Colorado, and as soon as that sells, he's out here. So that's looking pretty good. And it's a single-purpose camera. You don't take pictures of the kids. Okay, here's my personal recommendations. These are not recommendations, but they're just kind of suggestions. Many of you would have totally different than this, but I wanted to kind of set this up by budget, because this is all a function of budget. And before I look at these, I want to say this. The budget is a relative term, because this is not the price you see advertised in Sky and Telescope magazine. You go to AstroMart. In other words, you pick out what you want and then go to AstroMart, which is the eBay for astronomers, and you can find just about everything at a substantial discount, much of it hardly ever used. In fact, these prices you could probably cut in half in many cases. So what if you want to spend $500? Well, you could get a small reflector, you know, a 4-inch, maybe a 6-inch, and the mount comes with the package with that size. And then you get a digital point-and-shoot camera. You could take wonderful pictures of the moon and the planets. Short exposures, so you're not going to take deep sky images, but it's a great starter package. It's awesome to take those first pictures of the moon or of Saturn and see the rings or of Jupiter and the bands. Well, you decide, I want to go a little bit farther than that. Well, if you're willing to spend $2,000, and again, you can cut these in half on AstroMart, you get a small reflector with the mount included, and you get a DSLR, a digital single-lens reflex camera. Now, not only the moon and the planets, but you can take longer exposures. You can take some of the brighter deep sky objects, certainly M31. That many of the Messier objects you'll be able to take, with, in fact, if not all of them, with this setup. What if you want to go up to 6,000? Well, now you can get a really, you can get a an apochromatic refractor. The TAC Sky 90, which I have, and a review of that telescope by Sky and Telescope magazine. Oh, it's been 5 years, three to five years ago. The reviewer said this may be the finest telescope ever built. I thought that was a little bit of an overstatement, but still it made me pleased that I bought that camera, that telescope. A German equatorial mount, you can get the lower-end Takahashi mounts, for example, and a CCD camera, a low-end CCD camera for this much. What do you get for that? Absolutely flawless optics, unlimited exposure times. You're in the APOD territory now. You have the potential to take astronomy pictures of the day on the NASA website. These are all wide-field images. There's no magnification here. $10,000. It's the same thing, except you upgrade from a 90 to 130 millimeter, from a 3.5 to a 5-inch telescope, meaning the images are going to be significantly bigger. $25,000, plus or minus. That's the kind of the mini RC, 12-inch, with a Paramount mount CCD camera. Again, it's all of the above, except, well, you're going to have higher magnifications possible. Now, let me give you some photos, some actual photos I've taken with most of these setups, just to show you the difference between them, okay? Oh, there I am again. I keep coming back to this. It's important to teach the young, isn't it? So, in fact, my wife just left yesterday she lives in California with our daughter and son-in-law, and my wife just went out there to be with him for a week, so.
You look like you're saying, if you touch this again.
No, I want her fingerprints on that, except the mirror. Okay, let's look at some examples. Let's start with Mars. This is the first thing I imaged with a DSLR camera. There it was. Now, this just goes to show you what you can do. This is the potential. Well, it's not intended to be humorous. Okay, that brings this show to an end. Okay. That's all there is to it? Well, now, wait a minute. By the end of that summer, this was 03, when it came to its perihelion, or the closest to the Earth, not to the Sun, but it was about 34 million miles away. And I started taking, and I haven't mentioned that because that's a subject for another night, but I took some images with a webcam. And webcams are ideally suited for planetary imaging because imaging planets is not so much a function of the quality of your optics. It's the quality of the air, of the sky, the atmosphere, which is constantly changing like waves in a swimming pool. And there are moments of time, you've seen that visually, looking at Saturn, where you just almost gasp. There's a moment of clarity that runs out of the woods into the clearing, and you behold it in its glory for a second, and then it runs back into the forest again. And so it is with a digicam, you're taking thousands of images in a matter of a minute or two, and with software, it picks out the good ones and throws out the bad ones. It's like the exact opposite of the human diet. We throw out the good and eat well, that's the way the diet should be. Throw out the good taste and stuff and eat the bad. And so you end up with something like this. And you can compare that with the Hubble Space Telescope image. Taken from my garden. This was taken with my big RC telescope of Mars. Pretty good, yeah. I submit it. Yeah, the telescope. Maybe you're right. I thought that was Mars. But anyway, you remember the Spirit and Opportunity that we... Can you imagine? We sent them 50 million miles away. They soft land on the surface of Mars. And these rovers start running around the surface of the planet and take pictures and send them back to us. But you remember for about 10 days, we didn't see any pictures. And NASA was afraid. The computer said, touch any key to continue. But be that as it may, they eventually started sending back these images. Sunset on the Martian landscape. Is that awesome or what? Or how about this? These wide field images. And then this next picture was taken over here, Thomas, this is a top secret NASA photo that I've been able to get because of my connections. See the creature there that's pushing the boulder. He was the hairy one there. He was actually going over here to get some shampoo. You like that?
The hairy one looked like Bigfoot.
Okay, that was just a joke, Thomas, and the rest of you. Okay, now let's look at just a series of images. This was my first image I took of a galaxy. This was done with a 16-inch Newtonian reflector that I used to have. It had a German equatorial mount, so I could track for seconds with it. And I just put a camera on there with a 300-millimeter lens and shot a 30- or 60-second image. But it was exciting for me because that was the first image I took. That was probably 20 years ago. Now, this next picture is a picture I took with my DSLR digital camera about 3 years ago, before I figured out how to use the CCD camera. Now, compare that with this next one. There's the difference that experience and equipment can make. When I first processed this on my home computer, I almost passed out. It's kind of a dream come true. I wasn't the CCD camera, but I was able to use that DSLR camera. And you could take pictures. Now, I could take pictures far better than that. Because when I took this picture, I didn't really know how to track more than about 60 seconds. So this was like a 5x60-second image. Now I could take 5x10-minute images, no problem. And I'd like to go back and try that again, just taking some of those digital images. You know, because when you look at long exposures of M31, the spiral arms engulf M109. Isn't that true? Or they come close to touching it. Am I remembering that correctly? Maybe I'm thinking of M32. But even here, you can kind of see them out here. Here is my first picture of M33 in triangulum. This was taken from a dark sky with my little 3.5-inch fluorite refractor. Here was the same image taken with the 5-inch refractor. Bigger image scale. This next picture was taken with the 5-inch telescope. This is the 5-inch telescope with the DSLR digital camera. The next one is the same telescope, but this is after I learned how to use the CCD camera. In fact, this next picture is the first color picture I took with that camera. And you can see the difference. The depth, the color, the sensitivity. Much of that has to do with the fact that it's cooled. That's the image, by the way, that I sent to for consideration for an APOD. And have you ever sent an email and wish you could take it back? Well, that's kind of how I felt. Oh, man. You know, they have those Keck telescope images, Hubble Space Telescope. I mean, who am I to send, taken with my 5-inch camera from my driveway, light-polluted driveway? So, but a German astronomer emailed me about a week later, and he said, congratulations on your APOD for December 14th, 2004. I tell my kids, it's kind of like winning the Nobel Prize. You know, I did win the Nobel Prize in physics. I don't know if you knew that or not. When I was in college, I was a physics major my freshman year. And I came up with this idea. In fact, I had to switch majors to pre-law because most of the other physics majors already had calculus in high school. And I didn't because I was a basketball player at my high school. I was recruited by Bobby Knight to play at West Point, and which I didn't go. I didn't want chairs thrown at me. But that was the point I was going to make. Yes, let me tell you about the Nobel Prize. But I did have some creative ideas, and I came up with this idea that I explained to my professors, and they laughed me to scorn. And I kind of felt bad about it. And it was only in recent years that I discovered that that was the kernel of what was awarded the Nobel Prize in the 1980s, late 80s. Charles Higgs, an English professor who theorized the existence of the Higgs boson. That was the very idea that I had. So I always feel like I have a little partial credit for that. So you can say you talked to a Nobel laureate.
Maybe it was something you said that prompted.
Who knows where that goes? Yeah. But anyway, it's often interesting, isn't it, when you have people from other disciplines look, you know, Ludwig Wittgenstein, probably the greatest philosopher of the 20th century, spoke about what he called philosophical malnutrition of the West, meaning we tend to get so preoccupied with our own discipline, we don't see it from other perspectives. And that's what I brought to physics, you know, kind of a fresh, different, and I still do, I think, from my own perspective. And that's why I think it's important to study different disciplines. I'm always trying to study 3 to 5 disciplines outside of my own at the same time. Anyway, here's NGC 253, the Sculptor Galaxy, taken with a DSLR, just a digital Canon 10D camera hooked up to my 5-inch TAC refractor. Now, here's the next one, same telescope, CCD camera. Depth. Sensitivity. Here's M81, Bode's Galaxy in Ursa Major. That was taken with the DSLR. Here it is with the digital, with the CCD camera. That was a 2-hour image. NGC 891 in Andromeda. Digital. Single lens reflex, DSLR camera, 5-inch telescope, same telescope, CCD camera. Globular star clusters, here's M13, taken with the 5-inch refractor, DSLR camera, here it is with the CCD camera. Open star clusters, here's the Pleiades, these were all taken with the DSLR camera, double cluster. Double cluster again, M29, I think, M11 maybe. I don't remember what some of these are. Nebulae, this is my first picture taken like 20 years ago with a Nikon 300-millimeter lens of, can you tell what it is? M42, the Orion Nebula. Here it is taken with the DSLR. That was Nana Corday's photo of the day, my first one with a digital camera. There's the Vale Nebula DSLR 5-inch telescope. Here it is with a CCD. sensitivity, depth, color rendition. Look at this. Planetary nebulae. Those are some of the most awesome objects in the heavens. This was my first picture taken with the DSLR camera. I can remember the night. It's about 5 years ago now. I'd failed for a couple of years by then to use that ST7 SBIG camera. Couldn't do it. But I decided I'm going to start using my camera to take pictures. I didn't get that DSLR to take astrophotos. But I hooked it up one night, and I took this image. And I looked into my little viewfinder when it loaded that camera, and there I saw that little blue circle. I almost passed out. My first true astrophoto, really, you could tell what it was from looking at it. Here it was a few years later, taken with the 5-inch telescope with the DSLR camera. No, this was taken with the CCD camera now, okay? 5-inch camera, 5-inch telescope, and this is with the CCD camera. Now look at this next image. This is with my RC. This is the first picture I took with my 14.5-inch RC and CCD camera. Same camera as this, the ST10. The only difference is this is the 5-inch refractor. The next picture is a 14.5-inch RC. Notice the central stars, for example. We go from that to that. Look at the clarity, the resolution, the depth, the richness of color. That was selected by Astronomy Magazine as a photo of the day a couple months ago. But you can also see the image scale there. That's the true image scale. That's with the ST10 camera. The large format, STL 11000 series, forget it. You know, it'd be 1/4 or smaller than that. That's why I decided to hang on to the camera. I want to take these large-scale images of the planetary nebulae and remote galaxies. Now, here's, can you tell what that is? Al, M97, Ursa Major, DSLR camera, 5-inch refractor. This next picture is with the same 5-inch refractor with a CCD camera. I'm looking forward to taking that with the big RC. The Eskimo Nebula. Here it is with a DSLR and a 5-inch. The next one, the next one is with my Richie Creighton with the same camera. M27, the dumbbell and Vulpecula. This is with the DSLR camera, 5-inch telescope. Here it is again. Here it is with the CCD camera. This is my first image of M1 in Taurus, the Crab Nebula, taken with the 5-inch telescope and my ST10 camera. I used the ST10 camera for this with a PowerMate, 2x PowerMate, and now compare that to the RC. See the image scale there. I don't want to give that up. Miscellaneous, my first picture of the Milky Way, taken with a telephoto lens. Here is one I took a few years ago with my 3.5-inch tack with a CCD camera. There's M84 and M86 with the DSLR and the 5-inch telescope. Here it is with the CCD. M82. This is my most recent picture taken just a month ago with the 3-inch tack and the ST10 camera of M81, M82, and I don't remember, Dale, the name of that. It's an NGC object. All my pictures, many more than what I've shown here, you can see on my website. Many of you have visited that, seeoftheglory.com. And you enter here, and then there's a menu bar across the top of the next screen. And I mentioned to Bill earlier, I recorded with this recorder all my lectures, almost all of them, at Evangel, where I teach Intro to Astronomy. This has been my fourth year. I teach it in the spring semester on Monday nights, and I love it. And I think that passion will come through in those lectures. But you can listen to those at your pleasure. Just to show you a few comparison photos here, there's the big 4-meter telescope at Kitt Peak, Mount Palomar, Hubble Space Telescope, and my 3.5-inch refractor. I did this for my astronomy class, see if they could choose the difference. So which of these did I take, and which of these was taken by the Palomar Observatory? Well, this is my image down here. This is NGC 2419, the Intergalactic Wanderer in Gemini. One of these was taken by me, my 5-inch telescope. One was taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. Well, this is mine down here, B. One was taken by the, I think it's the Magyar telescope at Kitt Peak, 4-meter, 160-inch. One was taken by my 5, or was that the 3-inch, with the DSLR camera. Anyway, mine is B. M33, mine is B. Rosette, mine is B. And M81, mine is B. And the bottom line is this. This is not to show how great my technique is, but rather to show that rank amateurs that don't know what they're doing, I still feel that way about myself, can take images in their backyards that rival some of the greatest images from the largest telescopes in the world. That's what makes it so exciting to get into this sport. I'm going to pass over AL, because is my time up, Dale? Okay, well, we've got 15 minutes. Okay, then I'll go back and talk about this topic here, adaptive optics. This is a fairly recent discovery. We're talking about the late 80s, I believe, adaptive optics was discovered. The Hubble Space Telescope doesn't need AO, but all Earth-based telescopes do, to correct for the perturbations of the Earth's atmosphere, to the radiation that rains down on us. It's like writing your name on the bottom of an empty swimming pool and then filling it up with 10 feet of water and looking at your name. You know, it's just shimmering, isn't it? It's hard to read. That water is the equivalent of the Earth's atmosphere. We're looking through basically a swimming pool when we're observing or imaging. And what the adaptive optics device does, which has just been made available in the last 8 or 9 years on the amateur market by SBIG, 40 times a second, that mirror adjusts. And what it does, it takes the incoming perturbed wave fronts and they hit the deformable mirror that's reconfigured 40 times per second, and then they reflect off corrected wavefronts, and a much clearer, cleaner image emerges. It's kind of an atmospheric correction device. Now, I believe the first use of this was on the first Keck telescope on Mauna Kea in Hawaii. And let me give you an example of images it took of Io, one of the 4 Galilean satellites of Jupiter. Upper right was EO with the Hubble Space Telescope. No atmosphere. Lower right, EO with Keck 1 down here without adaptive optics. Look at this down here, the lower right. That's what the Keck telescope, 10 meter. Is that right? Yeah, 10 meter, 400 inch, 33 feet, took this image. Unbelievable. No discernible pattern at all or surface features. But now with the same telescope, just with an adaptive optics device like I just showed you, on the left is Keck 1 with adaptive optics, both of these images. Compare those to these and how much closer they are to the Hubble Space Telescope. This is part of the revolution, the digital revolution in amateur astronomy to your backyard. Now here is adaptive optics. This image I'm about to show you was just released by the Keck Observatory a year or two ago, which using adaptive optics, they took pictures of the center of our galaxy, Sagittarius B, I believe it's called. And never before was this possible, before adaptive optics. But with adaptive optics, look at what they've seen at the very core of our galaxy. Look at that, Thomas. Just think of what you're looking at here. Real-time motion. That yellow X there is the center, the geographic center, if I may use that term. Now let's zoom in a little bit. There's the center. right here. Now watch those stars. What are they doing? They're orbiting an invisible point. And watch how they speed up as they go around. Kepler's second and third laws of motion. Objects rotate faster as they get closer to the gravitational source. Newton figured that out as he modified Kepler's third law. We see it right here with our own eyes. And you can calculate the mass of that based on the orbits of those stars. It's calculated to be several million solar masses. A giant star-gobbling black hole in the center of our galaxy. How do we figure this out? Adaptive optics. Pardon me? Yeah, the resolution. Yeah, absolutely. Without adaptive optics, you know, you're looking at this image right here, you would have seen maybe nothing or just a white blur. No resolution whatsoever. Just look at EO. You know, look at this. This is what we were seeing before adaptive optics. Now we have this kind of resolution even through the atmosphere. And these were Keck observatory images, so they were shooting through the atmosphere. But they're at 14,000 feet on Mauna Kea. So they're above 98% of the water vapor. And oxygen level up there is about 40% of sea level. That's why astronomers aren't up there. They're down at the beach. They do. Absolutely. It's right here. Has anybody seen these? This right here. Well, how much does that thing cost? I think it's about $1,500 for the SBIG model. Large format. I just personally haven't seen a need for it yet, but all the advanced imagers use it. But Brad Earhorn told me I wouldn't need it, so I'm at RCOS. So I just want to, you know, become comfortable with the equipment, and if I decide I need it, I'll, you know, see if anybody is out there on AstroMart wants to sell one. Who has one?
I have one.
What do you think?
Well, I haven't used it yet.
Okay.
So I'm just getting set up.
All right. What kind of camera do you have? The big, large format?
An STL 4020.
Oh, 4020. And what's your optics?
The 14-inch.
Okay, very good. I'll be interested to see how that works out. So you're on the fork mount, or do you have a...
Fork mount.
Okay. There's the Gemini telescope. They use the T-point. That's what I use every night that I roll the telescope. They used it once. Man, they ought to hire me as a technician up there. Just like when I was finished with that Herschel 400 without aid using that 20-inch Dobsonian. I got so skilled at finding objects with that thing, I told somebody I'm going to put an ad in the paper, Starship Navigator for hire. And my friend said, just be sure you put a return P.O. box number. You don't want them calling your home. But a lot of people would take me up on that, wouldn't they? So anyway, there you go. AO. Fascinating.
Now, is that galaxies that you're seeing there?
Those are stars at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Isn't that amazing? And again, using Kepler's third law as modified by Newton, just a simple 400-year-old equation, by calculating the period of this orbit and the semi-major axis, or the radius of the orbit, you can compute the mass of both objects, the rotating object and the central object. And the rotating object you can basically disregard because its mass is negligible. No, no. With that equation, you'll know the mass of both objects. And just like with the sun and the Earth's mass is so negligible, you can disregard it. And what we're measuring the mass of the sun with Kepler's third law. Newton is the one that figured out, well, you're measuring the mass of the sun because you're not introducing the Earth's mass into the equation because you don't need to. He did. He transformed Kepler's third law into a tool that we use today to measure the masses of binary stars, as Bill knows. And galaxies, too, I might add. Certainly rotating galaxies, galaxy pairs, but there are ways now that this principle can be applied even to a single galaxy by measuring the rotational speed of stars within that galaxy. That's how we discovered dark energy. Because we see that in the in galaxies like Andromeda and other spirals, the as we would expect, the speeds are faster toward the middle. The stars are moving faster. And they start slowing down to about five, what is it? It's about 5,000 light years. And from 5,000 light years on, for another 50,000, it becomes constant. There's no way to account for that unless there's massive amounts of matter there that we can't see. In fact, about four to five times more mass than we can see, and that's the dark matter, not the dark energy. Okay, there's a Russell Crowman's observatory in New Mexico. It's kind of the, I mean, just ideal image. He's got the 20-inch RC in there, and it's remotely controlled. He lives in Austin, Texas. He's a computer chip designer, and he's built the whole thing. I'll tell you what, the more I've thought about it, there's so many things that can go wrong. And what are you going to do? Drive to New Mexico? And so I just can't bring myself to do it. We're going for the 25 miles out of town plan. Anybody interested, you know, let me know. We'll increase the pad. It's insured. You know, yeah, that's right. But he has cameras all over this thing, outside and inside. And what do you do about covering the mirror and keeping dust off it? I mean, that's just a simple project, and I wonder what he does about that. Okay, now the last thing we haven't talked about, and I'll just take a minute to go over this quickly because it's really a topic for another night. It's you've taken the images, and now what do you do with them? That's where it's more of an art than a science now. And this is the artistry of image calibration and development. Just to show you some examples, here's a raw photo of the Rosette Nebula. Here is a digitally developed image. There's M31. These were DSLR photos. Raw image of M31. You can see the blooming here. That was one of the raw images I took for the APOD. So this is what they look like on your laptop monitor. But I took 2 hours of luminance images and then 30 minutes of red, 30 minutes of green, 30 minutes of blue, and 5 minute subs. And software combines them all and subtracts the dark frames. This was a raw image of M81. You can see the blooming starting here. The software removes the blooms pretty much. There's a T-point. Brings back many bad memories. But some victories, too, out there in the dark. And I use Maxim DL. But once you get those images, you got to process them. And there's wonderful software. Maxim DL does almost everything automatically for you. And there's that image I just took of M81 and 82, showing you kind of the screen there in Maxim with all of these options you've got up here. I obviously don't know what all of those mean, but I'm learning. And may I conclude my presentation with that thought? It's a marvelous thought. It's an ennobling thought that the issue is not the quality of your image. Just like, who was it? Da Vinci or Michelangelo was once asked, what is your favorite painting? And he said, the next one. And so it is with astrophotography. Painting light. The issue is not the quality of that image you just took. It's, are you making progress? And are we moving toward the goal? I remember Mark Smith, who teaches English at Missouri State University. I used to know Mark when I played competitive chess. And I would see him at tournament after tournament, never be in the slightest flustered, and he was the best chess player in Springfield at that time, never bothered by losing a game. And so I asked him once about it. He said he did not play chess to win. He played to improve. And I've thought about that so often, and I've applied that very principle to astrophotography. The issue is not winning, how many APODs you get. The issue is, are you making progress, and are you enjoying what you're doing? And I have found each has its place, visual and imaging. And I've derived tremendous pleasure and satisfaction and inspiration from both. And so that's my comments for tonight. Dale, do we have time for Q&A, or do you want to just bring it to an end? 5 or 10 minutes?